Dvořák's setting of the Requiem. We heard the voices of Brigitte Fassbender, Thomas Moser and Jan-Hendrik Reuteling with the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra and chorus conducted by Wolfgang Zawalisch. Dvořák's final trip to England came after a gap of some 5 years in 1896 when he premiered one of his best-known pieces, the Cello Concerto, which we'll hear from on Friday. Dvořák did most of his composing after 1880 at his summer retreat at Vysoká in the depths of the countryside. More of that tomorrow, plus some of the most significant works he wrote before his next major venture abroad, including his concert overture, Carnival, part of the most bohemian of all Dvořák's operas, The Jacobin, and a complete performance of his ever-popular Dumky Trio.
And Donald MacLeod is back with Composer of the Week tomorrow at the programme's regular time of 6:30. Hello, I'm John Shea. Welcome to Tuesday evening on BBC Radio 3. It's now 7 o'clock. Time for us to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. It's presented by Andrew McGregor.
After yesterday evening's essentially Slavic prom of Tchaikovsky, Shimonovsky and Rachmaninoff, our Norwegian visitors, the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra, take us to the heart of the Austro-German symphonic tradition, Vienna, for two works, separated by almost a century, written by composers at quite different stages of their careers. After the interval, Vasily Petrenko conducts Anton Bruckner's Fourth Symphony, the one the composer himself christened his Romantic Symphony. And in the first half, the Oslo Philharmonic is joined by its fellow Norwegian pianist Christian Ihle Hadland, who's a BBC Radio 3 New Generation artist, for Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 2, which was actually the first one he finished after almost a decade of tinkering and revision, but it was published second, which is why the next one became number one in print. And Christian Ihle Hadland obviously enjoys encountering Beethoven's earliest concerto.
I think we can clearly see that this is a work that was at least sketched when he was, I think, only in his late teens, actually. First scores are from, I think, when he was 16, 17, and then he worked on it for a few years and make several different versions later on until this final version came when he was about 30. So clearly it is a piece that was written to promote Beethoven as a pianist. But also it's interesting to see that Die Kadenza has really clear signs that this is much later Beethoven. And I think it's nice of him that probably when he played the concert the first times, the cadenzas were much less, how should I say, controversial. So I'm very thankful to him that he decided to include this cadenza in the late version, because it really gives the concert some extra, how should I say, energy.
Christian Ihle Hadland. And it's actually the first time he's been to a prom. In fact, his first time at the Royal Albert Hall, his proms concerto debut. Well, the Oslo Philharmonic's leader, Eliza Botnes, got a huge cheer from the promenaders as she gave the A for the Oslo Philharmonic. And now here to perform Beethoven's B-flat major piano concerto No. 2 is Christian Ihle Hadland and the orchestra's chief conductor designate, Vasily Petrenko.
Thank you.
Beethoven's V-flat major piano concerto number 2. Although it was the first one he wrote and repeatedly revised, you just heard it played here at the BBC Proms by our visitors from Norway, pianist Christian Ile Hadland and the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra with its Russian chief conductor Vasily Petrenko, and Beethoven's own first movement cadenza, as Hadland was telling us just before the performance. Well, he leapt to his feet as soon as he'd finished and immediately shook hands with conductor and everyone he could reach amongst the strings. Huge grin on his face as he comes back onto the platform. Christian Ile Hadland, his concerto debut at the Proms. He was telling Sean Rafferty on In Tune yesterday, not only had he never been to a prom before, but today was actually his first visit to the Royal Albert Hall, and he was telling me this morning that he was loving the space and the sound, and that, well, he wasn't nearly as nervous as he'd feared. He said he felt much more nervous for his Proms chamber music concert last week with his fellow new generation artist, the Signum Quartet, at Cadogan Hall. And he told me that he normally felt less nervous for chamber music, but it felt like it got his Proms debut nerves out of the way early. Obviously no sign of them this evening. Off they go again. Petrenko applauding as he follows in Hadland's wake. And his next concert, in fact, the next concert for all of the musicians on stage today, is tomorrow in Dublin. Not Beethoven, though. They wanted something Nordic. So, guess what? It's going to be Grieg's piano concerto tomorrow. Back he comes, Christian Ile Hadland. They're still cheering. I wonder if he's going to do the traditional thing on his debut. He is. We're going to have more music. Music by Couperin for Christian Ile Hadland's encore here at the Proms this evening. I think that's the TikTok shot. It's originally for two manual harpsichords, which makes it quite complicated for the hands the pianist on a single manual, the fingers interlocking, quite interesting. I couldn't actually see from here because he's got his back to me on the platform, but that's what I remember. Well, his 2 years as a Radio 3 New Generation artist is coming to an end. The next six young artists were announced just yesterday on In Tune. And the artists for 2013 to 15 include the Danish String Quartet, and two pianists as well. One from China, one from Switzerland. All six of them coming to a radio near you soon. Exciting times ahead for them and us, as I'm sure Christian Ila Hardland would be only too happy to tell you after his 2 years as a New Generation artist. Off he goes again. Obviously enjoying his concerto debut here at the Proms. Well, Beethoven's second piano concerto had its first public performance in Vienna in 1801. In the same city, exactly 80 years later, Anton Bruckner's Romantic Symphony, his fourth, was given what was for him an unusually successful premiere. And that's the single work we're going to hear in the second part of this evening's Prom. And the interval gives us a chance to find out more about Bruckner and his background in our 20-minute Proms Plus introduction. Just before this evening's concert, I was joined on stage at the Royal College of Music by writer, broadcaster and music historian Roderick Swanston and by Canon Klaus Sonnleitner, who's following in Bruckner's footsteps as monastery organist at the Abbey of St. Florian. We're here to find out more about Anton Bruckner before we listen to his romantic fourth symphony in this evening's Prom. Roderick Swanston, even in a symphony like the fourth, we can't escape ideas of church belief and faith, or at least that's what this evening's conductor Vasily Petrenko told me.
Well, one of the great things about Bruckner is you can read almost anything into it. I mean, we know that he was a deeply religious man, deeply Catholic religious man, and his belief obviously got into his church music. But there is no evidence that they got into the symphonies unless you make a little leap between it. And in fact, Bruckner left a rather fragmentary programme when he revised the symphony in the late 1870s. And here it has nothing to do with church, it has with medieval knights. The problem with, it's not that you can't read a religious thing into it. The trouble is if you do, then you make it sound like evensong. So it gets very slow and sepulchral, and it has an ideology built into it, into how you're going to interpret it. So I get my stopwatch out tonight to see whether he's gone into ecclesiastical mode.
Now, Klaus Sonnleitner, you're the organist at Bruckner's old church, the Abbey of the Augustinian Monastery of St. Florian in Linz. I should say near Linz, because it's not actually in the city. It's a little distance outside, isn't it?
Yes.
But can you describe how Bruckner would have first seen the Abbey? Because his mother took him there as a 13-year-old, didn't she, to see if he could be taken on as a singer?
Bruckner was born in the small village of Ansfelden near Linz, and his father was school teacher. And Ansfelden Parish Church belongs to the Abbey of St. Florian, and there's also a Baroque parish house built by the same master builder who planned the monastery itself. When Bruckner's father died, he was 13 years old, and at this point, the mother of Bruckner had to look, how can I take care of my family, of my children, how can I get along? And she took him and walked to the monastery of St. Florian, about 2 hours, and introduced him to the prelate, to the provost of St. Florian, with the request to receive him as choir boy. And this, I think, was perhaps the most important decision in the whole life of Anton Bruckner. And you may imagine, perhaps, the widow Bruckner and the young Anton, or Tonal, are walking through the fields and forests, and then the approach to the monastery itself with this magnificent Baroque architecture, 204 meters long, a center of faith, culture, and arts, as well as a social and economic center, the largest organ of the monarchy, the heaviest bells ringing, And it's really absolutely breathtaking. It's like the approach to Castle Howard or something like
it
this.
Is, and it's so ornate.
I mean, in some sense, it's quite difficult for people who've never been there to imagine what it must have been like for a 10-year-old. The first thing has to remember that these big monasteries, these big Baroque ones built along the Danube, were a celebration of the success of the Habsburg Empire over the Ottomans. And it's the church militant, so they were magnificent. They were designed to be, as it were, not exactly heaven on earth with hair shirts, but heaven on earth with gold. Gold upon gold upon gold, magnificence. And they were all built on a hill. And if you were as poor as the Bruckners were, like school teachers are from then till now, you looked up the hill to the place you could aspire to. And it must be as close now to a little boy aged 8 to go into the chapel of King's College, Cambridge, when you have no impressions in your life, and to have your jaw drop to see that magnificent architecture, which is why I think he kept returning to it, both for his career and eventually to be buried there.
And this became Bruckner's musical home for, well, the next few years, and he was eventually the organist there as well. Do we know what kind of an organist he was? Because he wrote so little organ music. I mean, presumably this is because he was such a great improviser. He didn't yes. have to sit and write it down.
His self-image was to be the improviser and the composer of symphonies without church and without religion, as Roderick said. And improvising on the organ, this was his veritable strength, and at the organ, he developed a remarkable personal style. Unfortunately, we therefore don't have larger organ compositions of Bruckner, except some early pieces which have more the character of counterpoint studies.
But you have brought a piece of music that we can hear to give us an idea, perhaps, of how Bruckner might have improvised. It's a fantasy made up of sketches of Bruckner's first symphony, isn't it?
Yes. He played in 1890 the wedding ceremony of the Archduchess Marie Valerie, the daughter of Franz Joseph, the first emperor of Austria, in Ischl, where the summer residence was. And he proposed to improvise over themes from his first symphony. He revised in that time, in 1890. It originally was composed in the 1870s.
Well, this is Klaus Sonnleitner himself playing the Festmusik based on the Bardischl sketches on the Emperor's Jubilee organ in Bardischl. Just a short excerpt, obviously, but that's Klaus Sonnleitner playing some Festmusik based on sketches for Bruckner's first symphony. And Klaus, before we go on, you're playing what's now called the Bruckner organ in the Abbey of St. Florian, and beneath you, every time you play it, is Bruckner's sarcophagus. He wanted to be buried there, and he's in the crypt underneath. That must be a very strange thing to get used to.
Yes. His relation to St. Florian was so strong that he came back every year in summer. He made a holiday, he visited friends. He composed in his room, always the same room. You can come there and live there. It's a guest room. I'm the guest master and have the keys for you. And he finished there the second symphony and also the first version of the fourth symphony we are going to hear then. And he arranged his burial place with the prelate of St. Florian because he wanted to be buried in a freestanding sarcophagus at the most prominent place in the crypt of the church, directly beneath the organ. which he loved so much and which gave him so much inspiration for his work. And every time when I'm playing the organ, I know Bruckner is still there.
And do you hear the influence of Bruckner's sacred music and his and what we know of him as an organist in the symphonies?
I'm sure that that his personality, his religious personality, is always in the background, but it's often instrumentalized. I think biographers and writers did turn this often into a one-sided description of Bruckner as the Musikant Gottes, you know, this term, the musician of God, perhaps a bit over...
They do it too much, yes, for you. Now, we could spend the rest of our time just talking about different editions and the revisions, particularly for the Fourth Symphony this evening. But you have brought us a couple of recordings, Roddy, when, including the original 1874 version, Roger Norrington's
recording. Can I prelude that before, yes, we hear it and introduce this? Because this, in a sense, is like watching Miss Marple meeting Poirot, because it's the most wonderful detective story which has gone on. And it's partly to do with the fact that Bruckner's lack of success, relative lack of success, until very late in his life, and then even so, it was not very, very successful, led to the fact that there were no real definitive editions of any of his music that were in print. Imagine, when Brahms gets it, he does sketches, he writes a final version, he revises the final version, and then burns the sketches. So what people perform is what's in print coming out of Simrock. This is not the case with Bruckner. For instance, in the Fourth Symphony, there are four versions, and he revised it substantially once and then substantially internally again after that. And from this, of course, it's led in the 20th century, which is really the time he came to people's attention, for people to try and arrive at a definitive edition. And you wouldn't think that was very difficult. Off goes a scholar, probably with a grant, goes into a library in somewhere, picks up all the sketches, works out the authenticity of the sketches, puts all the notes in the right place, puts the accelerandos in the right place, and the written, yeah, you would think so. The trouble is, while these were being constructed, another ideology was going on at the same time, which became much more clear in the 30s, and that is the rise of Nazism. In particular, the search for an Aryan symphonist, as opposed to someone corrupted in the city like Brahms and supported by Jewish critics like Hanslick and so on. So it got tied up with a kind of ideology, which is where, of course, people start to say this great sort of church piece and so on, even though the Nazis are not so keen on that. So when they appointed an editor of a new Bruckner Ausgabe to correct edition, they appointed a member of the party called Robert Haas. And when he came to look at something like the Eighth Symphony, into that he incorporated a little bit of himself. His solution to what Bruckner intended was based on what he thought Bruckner ought to be. This was all then undone when Haas lost his job for obvious reasons in 1945 and replaced by a man called Leopold Novak, who took a slightly different view of it. But even then, British critics like Derek Cook would say, oh, well, we don't need to bother with any of the early versions. They're simply sketches. The problem is that Bruckner put the sketches into the Imperial Library in his will and said something like, soon they will understand, i.e., the revisions which had gone into print weren't really what he intended. Nothing could be more complicated. So with the Fourth Symphony, there are four versions. The first one he wrote is in 1874. And until comparatively recent, you couldn't get a copy of this, but now you can get a recording of it. Because Roger Norrington, with the Stuttgart Orchestra, recorded in Stuttgart, did a performance of the 1874 version. And this is how the finale opens of that version. Maybe it's worth almost immediately hearing the same movement conducted by Furtwängler in an edition which will be played tonight from the late 1880s. And for those of you who don't know this symphony very well, it begins for the first two or three seconds the same. Bum, 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 bum. Then the next thing you hear in the Norrington is a quotation from the beginning of the first movement. Bum, bum, ba, bum. Then after a while, you hear when it reaches the climax, the tune bum, bum, dum, like that, that you hear, which is where the example has just finished. In the Furtwängler version, i.e. in the late 1880s version, what you're going to hear is the repeat of the opening of the first movement doesn't appear at all. He cut that out. He replaced it by this very grand theme. And when Furtwängler conducts it, you will notice that he begins very much as though he was in church, and then he gets rather excited, and he adds a rather exciting and thrilling accelerando up to the... The accelerando doesn't appear in the score. This is Furtwängler's invention.
That's a very different sound, isn't it? That's the Vienna Philharmonic and Wilhelm Furtwängler in October 1951. Probably quite a different sound to today's Vienna Philharmonic as well, who are coming to the Proms to play Bruckner's Eighth Symphony with Lauren Marzell this coming Friday. Roderick, we heard Norrington going back to the original score, as close as he's prepared to, for the finale of the Fourth Symphony. We heard Furtwängler in 1951, a very different approach, and much more of that sort of grandiose late 19th, early 20th century tradition of Bruckner performance. And we know all the clichés. We know about these people saying that his symphonies are cathedrals of sound. We tend to look through stained glass at Bruckner when we think about his symphonies. Are our ideas of his music changing?
Well, I hope so. And certainly Norrington is doing his best to change our view of what that should be, and other performers nowadays, because he needs to be rescued from a particular kind of tradition of playing it. I mean, to some extent, Wagner was thought of like that, and if you trace how Wagner was performed from when we know he conducted, for instance, the Prelude to Meistersinger, he did it, and it took him 8 minutes. It took Klemperer 11 and a half minutes. For a piece which is that short, it had got slower and grander. And unfortunately, in a sense, Bruckner suffers from a reception. I'd have to make sure that we make the point about the difference between the Norrington and between the Furtwängler, and that is it's a different piece. It may be very grand, but the notes are completely different. So it gives us a very good idea of what he thought his symphonies might be by the revision. Or was it his idea, or the people who corrected his ideas and persuaded him? Or was it the idea of orchestras who did a whole lot of things without being told what to do? Can you believe it? So in a sense, a whole lot of things, untangling the web. And I think what I'd like people to be able to do is to relook at Bruckner as a symphonist who stands in the line of Schumann, Mendelssohn, and particularly of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I think in some ways we need, as it were, to rescue him from being the embodiment of a sort of messianic vision. Not exactly a religious vision, but an ideology of a symphony that could last as long as the Third Reich. And it's hard to untangle the whole ideology to make him a real man living in the 1860s and 70s, hearing Wagner for the first time, deeply embedded in polyphony, in the music of Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and Schubert. One of the most striking things about the Fourth Symphony you're going to hear tonight is after he's begun this rather, you know, the sense of the knights advancing or whatever the meaning of the opening is, you break for a moment and you're absolutely in a moment of Schubert. It comes from the Austrian countryside near where he lived. It has nothing to do with the vision of heaven. In some ways, it's an aspect which, if you perform it too sepulchrally, too much with the sense of, you know, this is a man writing these great spaces, you would miss that almost witty point he makes when doing these. And that's the thing I really like about the Norrington recording. Having stripped it away, whatever you think of the edition, it's sort of like Sidney Smith, if you remember, the reverend who made witty remarks, seeing two women shouting at each other from the top of two buildings. And he said, those two women will never agree because they are arguing from different premises.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thank you very much indeed, Roderick Swanston and Klaus Zonleitner. Was a discussion recorded earlier this afternoon across the way at the Royal College of Music, and the producer was Juan Carlos Jaramillo. And there are just a few proms pluses left before the last night of the proms. Look online or in the proms guide for details, and don't miss Klaus Zonleitner's performance on the Royal Albert Hall organ to begin Friday's prom. Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the proms here in London's Royal Albert Hall. It's hard to believe that after 2 months and 69 proms, we've almost reached the last night. By the way, I misidentified the encore that Christian Ila Hadland gave us after the Beethoven in the first part. It was actually William Byrd. I ought to be able to tell the difference between my French and English keyboard composers. Byrd's Galliard from my Lady Neville's book. This evening, our visitors from Norway, the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra and chief conductor Vasily Petrenko, are conjuring up the atmosphere of 19th century Vienna in 1801 with Beethoven, which we heard before the interval, and now with a major symphony from almost the other end of the century, Anton Bruckner's Fourth, the one he himself decided to call his Romantic Symphony. You could call any of his symphonies romantic in one sense, so perhaps what he meant was the concept of courtly love popular in medieval high society, given the simple descriptive programme Bruckner provided for early performances, a vision of dawn over a medieval city in the first movement, a procession of knights venturing forth, then the magic of nature envelops them, and there's a hunt in the third movement scherzo. But it's hard to tell, given Bruckner's insecurities about his symphonies, whether this was a concept he cared about or whether it might have been forced on him by those who thought his music needed help to reach an audience. For our conductor, though, Vasily Petrenko, there's a bigger picture.
Bruckner, he really asks questions. What are we in face of nature, in face of God? What are we? What are the nature of humans? Of course, he wrote this program about mourning and then horn calls and the beautiful landscapes and the valleys, etc., etc. But I must remember, he was always a very faithful person. He spent most of the time serving church, serving God. As an organ player, as a symphonist, writing pieces like Te Deum, which is massive belief. And I think he also been raising for himself, first of all, those questions. If the nature is so beautiful, and if the God created that, why then we humans, we need to suffer? Why then we have so much drama and pain in our lives? Why can't we live in harmony with nature? And all that, especially in the finale, with all the segments, it's like a puzzle, this finale, and to bring it all together and to create this movement towards the final appearance of initial theme through all the fight for it. This is quite a big task for conductor and for the orchestra, but that's what he was writing about. I think he was writing about this eternal journey of human towards the most beautiful world and towards the most beautiful society, towards the fairest society, towards the fairest world, through the God, through the nature, or through the social things.
Tonight's conductor, Vasily Petrenko. Well, the Oslo Philharmonic's leader is Eliza Botnes, and here is Petrenko to conduct them in Anton Bruckner's Romantic Symphony No. 4, which we'll be hearing in the Novak edition of Bruckner's revised 1880 score.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
After so much doubt, rewriting and revision, there's no doubting the blazing certainty at the end of Anton Bruckner's fourth symphony, the one he himself called his Romantic Symphony, performed for us here at the BBC Proms by the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Vasily Petrenko. And as we reached that final conclusion, the smile of almost ecstasy spreading across his face was a vision as well. Back he comes. Applause from the orchestra, the strings tapping their bows as well. And that roar was for principal horn Inga Besserudhagen. And immediately after she'd got to her feet, she made sure the rest of her section stood as well. Section by section, the brass standing, now the winds. And the strings. Vasily Petrenko shaking hands with the Oslo Philharmonic's leader, Eliza Bodnas. Well, I hope that's whetted your appetite for Bruckner. It's one of the most eagerly anticipated concerts in this last week of the Proms is Friday's visit from the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, will be conducted by Lauren Marzell in Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. Meanwhile, for the Oslo Philharmonic's next concert, Petrenko takes them to Dublin tomorrow, opening the National Concert Hall there's international season. Back he comes. The orchestra stands. Petrenko, pretty much the tallest man on stage, touches his heart and offers his appreciation to the crowd in front of him. He has a really nice, easygoing relationship with the orchestra, as we heard in rehearsal. All in English, by the way, the rehearsals, in case you were wondering. When they were sorting out some rehearsal issues in the Szymanowski concerto for yesterday's Prom, he described the sound as porridge, and then very good English porridge. Here he comes again, and the bows tapping still on the music stands. And looking at their faces, the grins, the smiles, the way they're looking at each other on stage, I think they've enjoyed this evening as much as the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall has. Well, it's the BBC Symphony Orchestra's turn tomorrow with Finnish conductor Osmo Vanska, and after Tchaikovsky's first symphony last night from our Norwegian visitors, the BBC Symphony Orchestra's playing his last, the Pathétique, as well as Goretzky's Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, and the world premiere of Anthony Payne's orchestration of Vaughan Williams's four last songs. So it's a trio of farewells, I suppose, when you think about it. But right now, let's bid a fond farewell to the Oslo Philharmonic Orchestra, who've been great company over the last two evenings. And we'll wish them a safe journey across the Irish Sea for tomorrow's concert in Dublin's fair city. Stamping, greeting Vasily Petrenko as he returns to the platform and puts his arm around the shoulder of the Oslo Philharmonic's leader. Glorious Bruckner to end their visit to the BBC Proms this season. And waiting for us back in Broadcasting House, here's John Shea.
Thank you very much to Andrew McGregor presenting tonight's First Prom live from the Royal Albert Hall. And as ever, you can listen to it again anytime you like over the next 7 days via the Radio 3 website. And if you missed our other Scandinavian visitors this week, Camerata Nordica, who gave last Saturday's Proms matinee at Cadogan Hall, well, you can hear their concert again tomorrow afternoon at 2, music for string orchestra by Britton, Tippett and Walton. Now, look ahead to next weekend here on Radio 3.
Pioneering artist Laurie Anderson traces the roots of possibly one of the most daring and popular of all contemporary art forms.
A retrospective of the work of Marina Abramović was presented in 2010 at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. In one part of the show, called The Artist is Present, she sat motionless for 3 months, while visitors could take a seat in front of her.
Living and Present. Laurie Anderson on Performance Art is the Sunday feature, Sunday night at 7:45 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, we're back at the Royal Albert Hall in just under 50 minutes from now for the second of tonight's proms, a late-night concert by the BBC Singers, featuring music by Benjamin Britten and George Lloyd. That's at 10 o'clock tonight. Before that, another chance to hear one of our features from earlier in the year, as Matthew Sweet tells the story of Dr. Alex Comfort, author of The Joy of Sex. That's in a few minutes at 9:15. So before that, a return to the Slavic theme of last night's first prom by the Oslo Philharmonic. Piano music here by Rimsky-Korsakov, played by Margaret Fingerhut. Scherzino, and before it a piece called A Little Song, two pieces by Rimsky-Korsakov, played by Margaret Fingerhut. This is BBC Radio 3, it's 9:15, and time now for tonight's feature. Last year marked four decades since the publication of The Joy of Sex. Its author, Dr. Alex Comfort, became synonymous with his best-selling book, but that image has blotted out an extraordinary career, as Matthew Sweet discovers now in a programme called Stop Calling Me Dr. Sex.
Alex Comfort, when he lived in California, he used to frequent this swingers community called Sandstone. It was a clothing optional community. Gatorley's, in this account, Thy Neighbor's Wife, describes this community and Alex Comfort's presence there. And Tilly's describes him wandering through this orgiastic scene, like a butterfly collector wandering through the fields, and he was smoking a cigar, looking approvingly at this adult playpen in this sex community. And apparently he was put the cigar down after a while and join in enthusiastically.
What's your position on the joy of sex? For most people, it's a big, thick, illustrated embodiment of the permissive society of the 1970s, a gourmet guide to lovemaking from an era when gourmet meant prawn cocktail and Black Forest gâteau. We're given to snigger at it, but we shouldn't, partly because its roots are as far away from the suburban key party and the swingers' hot tub as you could possibly imagine. Atrocity, injustice, barbarism, annihilation, the horror and violence of World War. These were the forces that shaped The Joy of Sex and its author, Dr. Alex Comfort. He was that guy tapping ash from his cigar on the margins of a Californian orgy. But he was also one of the most underestimated public intellectuals of the British 20th century, a man whose incredible range of enthusiasms, whose passion for ideas, has been lost in the shadow of that best-selling sex manual. In 1976, Alex Comfort complained, "I don't want to be known as Dr. Sex." And to the end of his life, he struggled to push the rest of his career and his achievements back into the light.
It was largely a matter of accident. And don't forget, sex is not my main activity. My main activity is aging. If you see those books up there, all books I've written, all the books about sex, very few of them about aging, and that's because there have been hundreds and hundreds of translations all over the world of this one book on sex. But it is a bit of an albatross around my neck.
But where did all this begin? In suburban North London, with something really quite horrible that happened long before the sexual revolution and the bombing of Hamburg, in the spring of 1935. This is the back garden where Alex Comfort played when he was a boy in the 1920s and 30s. It's also where he suffered an accident that might have stopped his extraordinary career from happening at all. With me is Alex Comfort's son, Nicholas. Nicholas, what kind of childhood did your father have here?
Well, it was a very happy one. I think it was fairly intense, though. The whole of the sitting room was lined with books, and he was encouraged to read them.
And a lot of these books on the shelves were about the First World War.
The First World War was a big part of my family's life because my grandfather had been seconded from County Hall to go up to Yorkshire and supervise the production of uniforms for the troops, and specifically the conversion of the uniforms that came back bloodied from the trenches into new cloth. And I think that sowed the seeds of pacifism in my grandfather, and I think this was probably a fairly powerful influence in my father following the same road.
The carnage of the trenches loomed large in the imagination of the teenage Alex Comfort. It haunted his reading too. Professor David Goodway is a leading scholar of Comfort's work.
When I first approached him, I asked him, when and how did you first become a pacifist? And he said, when I was a schoolboy, by reading First World War reminiscences.
But the horrors of recent history weren't his only teenage interest. He liked Meccano and mollusks and gunpowder.
It was the weekend of George V's Silver Jubilee, and my grandmother had grounded him from going to the cinema. And he and a school friend stayed home and started making fireworks in the greenhouse that used to be on the back of the house up there. And their first effort produced a large crater in the lawn. And my grandmother then sent his friend home. And Dad, being a persevering type, kept going. And he was working on getting everything into the tube when there was a stray spark. And the whole lot went up, including the greenhouse. The explosion basically destroyed his left hand. And he was obviously in a lot of pain. And while they were waiting for the ambulance, he actually rang his friend to say, please don't do this experiment because the same thing might happen to you. And fortunately, they got him into hospital and found an extremely accomplished surgeon who managed to reconstruct enough of his left hand that he still had a workable thumb.
And what happened in the aftermath?
My grandfather took him on a tramp steamer to Buenos Aires. He was fascinated by the life on board ship. And when he came back, he wrote a book called The Silver River, which was basically a more or less non-fictional account of his travels.
And he's still a schoolboy?
He's still a schoolboy. He was just 16 now. The book was called Diary of a Schoolboy in the South Atlantic.
I do not believe the fable that men read travel books to escape from reality. They read to escape into it. From a crazy wonderland of armaments, cant, political speeches at once insincere and illiterate, propaganda and social injustice, which the lunacy of humanity has constructed over a period of years.
just seem extraordinary that a boy who's undergone this traumatic experience, you know, loses these digits, his answer to this is become a writer.
It spurred him on. The people who felt the trauma were the rest of the family. One of his aunts left him £50 because he would never be able to earn his living. My grandmother first and then my grandfather realised that, tragic though it was, he was probably going to achieve even more than he would have done otherwise.
So Comfort emerged from that suburban garden as a writer and as a pacifist. Growing up in the bloody wake of the Great War, Comfort was hardly unusual in his opposition to armed conflict. But by 1940, his views were being tested by fire, the enemy's and Britain's.
At the moment we can see two bright flashes, three flashes from the other side of the channel, and three great puffs of smoke, another fourth. And any moment now the shells will be arriving over this side.
As the Nazis devoured the continent and Britain steeled itself for invasion, many of Comfort's fellow pacifists renounced their beliefs and took up the gun. And Comfort?
He sticks with it and becomes even more committed and goes on and doesn't relent and is a pacifist throughout his life.
When the war actually began, I think he simply saw more futility, more carnage and the like. And although he'd never have done anything to frustrate the war effort, he felt it very important to take a stand and register as a conscientious objector, even though, because of his disability, there was no chance of his being called up to fight. He was not in any way an uncourageous man. He went out with his tin hat on to treat casualties of V1 raids and the tail end of the Blitz. So he had observed all this at close hand. He just felt it was wrong, and that despite what many people were saying about the enormity of the enemy we were fighting, war was something one simply should not be associated with.
In 1941, Comfort was establishing himself as a poet. He was still only 21, but he was already making an impact on literary London, partly because of his pacifism. That's what got him into a skirmish with one of the big guns of that world, George Orwell.
Comfort also claims that Orwell's out of touch with young writers.
To thrash out what happened next, I brought together Comfort expert David Goodway and DJ Taylor, biographer of George Orwell, around a pub table in South London.
Which is wrong, yeah. There's a number of them were fighting in the middle.
In 1941, Comfort published his first novel, No Such Liberty, which was overtly pacifist and made provocative comparisons between Nazi Germany and wartime Britain. In October of that year, Orwell reviewed the novel in a Delphi magazine. So I asked David Taylor, how did he react to Alex Comfort and his arguments?
He described him as an absolutely pure pacifist of the turn-the-other-cheek variety.
Insofar as it hampers the British war effort, British pacifism is on the side of the Nazis and German pacifism, if it exists, is on the side of Britain and the USSR. Since pacifists have more freedom of action in countries where traces of democracy survive, pacifism can act more effectively against democracy than for it. Objectively, the pacifist is pro-Nazi.
Did Comfort turn the other cheek?
Oh, no, he hit Mac hard. So he comes back following year in Partisan Review. I see that Mr. Orwell is intellectual hunting again. He's very aggressive.
Perhaps he will grant that Hitler's greatest and irretrievable victory over here was when he persuaded the English people that the only way to lick fascism was to imitate it.
Inevitably, Britain would start to commit atrocities in the war against Germany.
We began feverishly jamming into our national life all the minor pieces of fascist practice which did not include socialist methods, sitting on the press because this is total war, making our soldiers jab blood bladders while loudspeakers howl propaganda at them because the German army consisted of efficient yahoos.
He asks our Orwell what the artist can most usefully do. He thinks it's by temporarily supporting the status quo rather than by wandering around in Epping Forest with a pocket full of hand grenades.
And so there's a kind of groundswell of anti-Orwell sentiment welling up in Partisan Review, and he replies with this enormous kind of 4 or 5 page screed defending himself against absolutely everything.
The idea that you can somehow remain aloof from and superior to the struggle while living on food which British sailors have to risk their lives to bring you is a bourgeois illusion bred of money and security.
The altercation between Comfort and Orwell doesn't stay on the pages of Partisan Review. It moves into Tribune, doesn't it? And it goes metric. Yeah. It goes into poetry.
A year later, Comfort bursts into Tribune with 15 satiric stanzas. Comfort has now moved on to become an anarchist as well as a pacifist, and he goes on a thoroughgoing assault against all the war criminals in England as he sees them. Against Churchill, he says...
You've heard his nibs decanting year by year, the dim productions of his bulldog brain, while homes and factories sit still to hear the same old drivel dished up once again. You've heard the church's cartwheels to explain why bonds are Christian when the English drop them. The union bosses scrapping over gain, while no one's the temerity to stop them. Or have the racketeers who try to bleed 'em flogged, like the Indians for demanding freedom.
Orwell's repast is quite, it's obviously hostile to Comfort, but it is quite nuanced because he doesn't indulge in Churchill worship. And there is a rather extraordinary line where he says that as for Churchill, he'll gladly shoot him when the war is done, or even before if there was somebody there to replace him. But then there's this killer couplet, I think at the end of the penultimate stanza, where having referred to the Comfort line about accepting the status quo, he says,
which will sound better in the days to come? Blood, toil and sweat, or kiss the Nazi's bum?
Which I think really brings the exchange to a conclusion.
Whatever you think about who won this literary argument, it does suggest that Comfort was an extraordinarily confident young man at this point.
Amazingly so. It's good for him. He develops his own theory of anarchism, his version of anarcho-pacifism.
And he's also engaged in some kind of dialogue with Orwell, who wrote to him in quite emollient terms after this exchange. They exchanged correspondence. They met once in 1945 in a pub in South London. And Orwell wrote for his magazine, New Road.
So they're closer then intellectually too than this exchange would suggest.
I think so, yeah. Orwell's own position had been very similar to Comfort just before the war.
And there is, in a rather oblique way, an interesting connection between Orwell's great masterpiece, 1984, and the career Comfort subsequently pursued. There's that marvellous paragraph in the novel where Winston and Julia are alone together, and she turns to him and says, you know, when you've made love to somebody, you don't give a damn. You don't care about whatever political systems may surround you. You know, you are free. You can then begin to live some kind of life that is truly yours. And I think that phrase could be said to underpin Comfort's subsequent theorising, the idea that the political structures that are most appropriate to humanity can only work after they've reconfigured their personal and emotional lives, and this is the way to begin it. So, in an odd way, I think that novel is quite closely related to a lot of Comfort's later thinking.
So there is some common ground here between them, intellectually. They both might have what you could call a kind of anarchist attitude to sex.
I think so. What Julia said is pure Comfort.
In 1942, the war took a turn that strengthened Comfort's opposition and made it clearer to him than ever that Nazi barbarism was nurturing the same instincts in the Allies. British Bomber Command directed its firepower against German civilians. It launched the 1,000-bomber raid on Cologne in 1942. In the following years, Allied bombs burnt the oxygen out of Hamburg, Berlin, and Dresden. Those campaigns remain controversial today, but in the heat of war, few on the British side offered any challenge to them. Few except Alex